This News Talk 1010 podcast is brought to you by PocketEmploymentLawyer.ca. Wrongfully dismissed? Changes made to your job? Lowballed on severance? Find out if you have a case before you call a lawyer. Go to PocketEmploymentLawyer.ca.
Hey, welcome to the backside of the program. Have you expanded your bubble yet? Michael Catherwood, technical producer of this program, he's expanded his bubble. I'm very, very proud of you. I have not. I still have eight spaces available in my bubble. If you want to apply, text me at 71010. And maybe I'll auction it off. Like, who wouldn't want to be in my bubble? Really, my circle of hugs. And get a hug from me. I've started a new app, but I need some investors. It's called Bubbler.
Yeah, sorry, my circle's full, Mark.
Yeah, I don't believe you. I think you're just excluding me. I've been bubble shunned. Don't be a bubble shunner. That's
hard decisions have to be made in these times, okay?
I'm hurt, Michael. I don't know if I can do the rest of the show. I don't know if you've noticed, but I have. It's been 2 weeks I haven't done the history segment. Nobody's noticed. I love the history segment, but my God, is it a lot of work. And it takes up some time that I could be using for longer form interviews. And so we're going to give that a try with a chance to have a conversation that doesn't have to be cut off after 8 minutes. And we're going to chat for a little bit here with one of my favorite guests. His name is Robert J. Sawyer. He is a superstar of science fiction. One of the best science fiction authors in the world. He's won every award you can win in science fiction. We've had him as a guest on the show to talk about different things because he brings a fascinating perspective about what this might mean. But we haven't really had time to talk with him about him. So, welcome back, Robert Sawyer. It's great to have you on the show again.
It's great to be back. Thank you so much.
So I want to start our conversation, I think, with your new book, which I finished, and it's really enjoyable, and then sort of get into how you became who you are. But your new book is called The Oppenheimer Alternative. It is out and available everywhere you buy books now. It's a fascinating mix of history and fiction, and to be honest, I found it very difficult to tell where the history was ending and the fiction was beginning, because a lot of the things that I assumed you had made up in this story about Robert J. Oppenheimer and the Manhattan Project, they were true. So
absolutely.
Go ahead.
Just for those who do read the book, and I hope they will read The Oppenheimer Alternative, on my website, just go to my website, sfwriter.com, F like in science, F like in fiction, sfwriter.com. And there's a whole page there detailing what's fact and what's fiction in the novel on a chapter by chapter basis. So, but the rule of thumb for this book, as you've discovered, Mark, is the more outrageous something Oppenheimer does in the book, the more likely it is to be something he did in real life. That man was the very definition of being his own worst enemy.
So I want to ask you where this idea came from and what was the process? I mean, did you just kind of develop an infatuation for the eccentricities of Robert Oppenheimer and decide you had to do something with this? Or did you have a story to tell and then kind of happen upon these historical figures that could be merged seamlessly together?
Well, actually, I'm a big theater buff, and touring the fringe festivals about 5 years ago was a play called The Inventor of All Things by a British playwright, a one-man show. The playwright's name is Jem Rolls, R-O-L-L-S, and it was about Leo Szilard, who was one of J. Robert Oppenheimer's colleagues. And in reading that novel, in seeing that play performed, I realized Szilard is fascinating, but this Oppenheimer character, I want to know more about him. And as you say, I just got obsessed. It grabbed me by the throat, and I couldn't let go reading about this guy.
The Manhattan Project, which of course was the top secret, super secret American effort to develop nuclear weapons during the Second World War, it brought together some of the best minds in science. When I look back at that, it's kind of hard to believe that they got all of those people together to work on something But then I often wonder, well, maybe it was the togetherness that made them so fabulous. And, you know, if it had been somebody else, we'd be in awe of what they did. Which do you think sort of came first there, the brilliance or the egg?
It really is. Yeah, it's a great question, because these guys all were, by and large, cushy university professors, right? They had really nice jobs, pensions, tenure, respect in their community. Most of them were married. Many of them had kids. And they had to say to their families, guess what? We're packing up and moving to the desert. I can't tell you why. I can't even tell you, my wife, my spouse, and it was almost all wives who weren't told in those days. But you got to go. You got to give up all those luxuries. If we're lucky, there will be a toilet in our cabin. If not, we'll have to share or use an outhouse. But that's where we're going, and I don't know how long it's going to last. Of course, the families, especially the spouses, hated it. Some of the kids were young enough to treat it as an adventure. But for these scientists, it was like the world's best summer camp. They were told, forget about students. Forget about faculty meetings. You know, they say the pettiest politics of all are academic ones because the stakes are so small. Forget all that. Come and do your science with an unlimited budget on the biggest project in human history. They were in hog heaven. And so for them, what turned out to unleash the powers of hell, quite literally the fires of hell, onto our planet was for them the greatest time in their lives. They were never more alive than when they were in that desert in 1943, 44, and 45.
And I can imagine coming off of that, after the war, after the two atomic bombs have been dropped, their work has been proven successful, the war is over, and the Manhattan Project is essentially no longer needed. So they're to disband and go to four corners of the earth. Having worked in teams as a military guy or on a political campaign, I know that psychic letdown at the end of a project weighs on you, and kind of, you know, you miss even the hardships during that effort. But in the Oppenheimer alternative, your new novel, they come across another sort of, you know, landmark, you know, possibly, you know, catastrophic threat that requires some of them to sort of stay together and to work on that. Where did you come up with that concept? Is that concept something that you've been thinking about for a long time, and then you knitted it together with this fascination with Leo Szilard and Oppenheimer? Or
yeah, you know, we often say that the closest thing to the Manhattan Project since the Manhattan Project was the Apollo moon effort, which, of course, was led by Wernher von Braun, one of the characters in my novel, a Nazi who was forgiven his sins and allowed to play with the biggest toys of all that we ever built, the Apollo rockets. But after the war, I thought, this is, you know, all great literature is about redemption, Mark, about people making up for the mistakes of their past in one way or another. My favorite movie, Casablanca, perfect example. Rick has sat out the war, and off he watches Casablanca my novel. Sits out the war until at the very end he says, you know what, the problems of two little people don't amount to a hill of beans in this crazy world. I'm going to join the fight. I got to man up and do what history requires of me. Well, when that is over, and you've done something that you've come to regret, instead of defeating Hitler, which is what they all thought they were going to do, instead they bombed civilian targets, not military targets, in Japan. And everybody practically involved with the project, with only two major exceptions, Edward Teller, the father of the hydrogen bomb, and Leslie Groves, the military of the project, came to have enormous regrets. But they really never got a chance to make up for what they had done. So I wanted to contrive a situation. My fictional part of the novel is that they have a reason to stay together and flip their karma. And Oppie was big on karma. He was a huge reader. He could read Sanskrit. He read the Bhagavad Gita, Hindu scripture, and give him his chance to have his karmic balance reset by becoming, instead of the destroyer of worlds, the savior of our world.
I'm talking with Robert J. Sawyer, a superstar science fiction author, about his new novel, The Oppenheimer Alternative. I've got about a minute before traffic, and then we're going to come back with Robert. But very quickly, because I don't want to force you to give away, you know, the ending of the novel, but I couldn't help but think at the end of your new book that it sets up an entirely new universe that you could explore with future stories. Is that going to happen?
So as with any one of these things, when you do a novel, you hope it's going to be a runaway success. Right now, the book has been out now for 12 days. So right now, all we know about is the reviews, which have been uniformly spectacular. I've been enormously gratified because I spent 4 years on this. You like to get a nice attaboy when you're done for it. The sales, that's up to your listeners and everyone else. If the sales are sufficient, then I was so enamored with these characters. I already have my title. This one is The Oppenheimer Alternative. The next one would be The Teller, referring to Edward Teller, father to Eichmann. The Teller Redemption.
Outstanding. Well, we'll hold on there for just a moment. I'm going to come back with more from Robert J. Sawyer. I'm going to find out how Robert J. Sawyer became Robert J. Sawyer. I mean, how do you go from some guy in Mississauga to one of the world's luminaries in the science fiction sphere? That's next. Right now, it's 3:15. Hey, welcome back. This is Mark Tuohy. You're listening to News Talk 1010. Thanks for tuning in. Much appreciated. We're talking with Robert J. Sawyer, who is a science fiction writer, one of the most successful in the world, who has won every award there is to win in the world of science fiction, and has a new book out called The Oppenheimer Alternative, which we were just talking about. It's seamlessly blending real-world history about Robert J. Oppenheimer and the scientists involved in the Manhattan Project with a future challenge in a way that you can't really tell which is history and which is fiction, but it's a thrilling book right to the very end. And I hope you get a chance to check it out. I just tweeted a link to it online. If you follow me on Twitter, at Tuohy, T-O-W-H-E-Y, definitely check it out. Robert, you're a Mississauga guy.
Yeah.
Let's talk a little bit about you for a minute. I mean, were you born and raised in Mississauga, or did you, for some strange reason, decided that that was the right place to live?
I was born in Ottawa, but only lived there for 4 months. My father was an economist. He's deceased now. But he worked for Statistics Canada in Ottawa, but got a job teaching at the University of Toronto. I was born in April of 1960, and he got a job starting after Labor Day, 1960. So we moved to Toronto. I grew up in North York, lived in downtown Toronto when I went to Ryerson, where I studied radio and television arts, and ended up in Mississauga. Actually, I'll tell you, because I love the town, and I don't want to put it down, but I was not looking here. My wife and I were looking for a bigger condo apartment than what we had, nowhere near Mississauga, and there was an ad for the place we bought. We have a lovely penthouse in downtown Mississauga that was misfiled in the real estate section. It wasn't supposed to be in that part of the newspaper. It was a Mississauga listing. And I said, this looks like it's got everything I've got we want, but it's by square one.
I was just going to ask, where is downtown Mississauga? But
Mississauga City Hall is just west of square one. Celebration Square is adjacent to square one, the City Hall, and the Central Library.
But you don't drive. You don't drive.
I don't. That is true.
Why don't you drive?
I was in a car accident when I was 10 years old, and it left me kind of uncomfortable about it. They never should have let me behind the wheel at 10. It wasn't me driving. But that's the reason. It's as simple as that.
So how do you live in Mississauga without a car? The whole point of Mississauga is to have a car.
Is by being self-employed. The beauty of my profession is I can do it anywhere in the world. In fact, sometimes I make a point when I'm traveling of posting pictures of me working on my novel on a laptop, wherever I happen to be. So I've done it, in the ruins of Pompeii, in the Roman Forum, in Singapore, in the Forbidden City, in Beijing and so forth, just because it's a portable profession. But, I have to go out somewhere that might require a set of wheels. We do own one. I've got a vanity license plate. People in Toronto may see it from time to time. It's SF Writer, SF for science fiction. I've had that for 20 years now on a succession of automobiles in that time.
So You mentioned travel. Are you one of these writers that travels to the places that he writes about on Earth? A lot of your novels are set here in the GTA or Ontario or Canada. But, for example, this the Oppenheimer alternative, did you go down to Los Alamos or do you do most of your research afar?
No, I did. But 20 years ago, I had been. And it had always stuck in my mind, to Los Alamos, to the White Sands Missile Range, to all of those places, for sure. I didn't go again for the writing of this book because I took pictures and I remember it well and so forth. But yes, I've certainly been to New Mexico, where all of this started. And I've not been to Hiroshima or Nagasaki, and that's a regret, because I have been to Japan several times, and I do want to make it to where the bombs actually fell at some point.
So you studied broadcasting and journalism in university, but when did you decide that you wanted to be a novelist, and then how did you actually take that step? Because, I've wanted to be a novelist most of my life, and here I am still, part-time radio guy.
So I mentioned my dad was an economist, and I said to him last year of high school, I think I'm going to be a writer. And my dad, he went to the University of Toronto and got the statistics from the federal government, the average income of writers in Canada, and photocopied it out of the Robarts Library and handed it to me without a word. And then he said, maybe you should actually get a degree in something and have a career to fall back on. And I thought, well, I had no aspirations to, I would have loved to, but I had no realistic hopes of ever writing the great blockbuster movie or even being on a major TV show. But there are all kinds of people who make livings writing news for television and documentary for radio and television. There are decent livings to be had in this town. And that seemed it would at least be writing for a living, if not writing the stuff I wanted to write. So it set the platform. And I never took my eye off the prize, though, and just kept pursuing it. I was 30 before my first novel came out. I'm 60 now. I've had 24 books in those three decades. But I just knew it's what I had to do.
You are probably as successful critically in the world of science fiction as anyone could be. Is it a good living? Like, you're also a Canadian writer. Can you make a good living doing this stuff?
So the answer is I have been extremely fortunate. So that the answer is yes, that I do make a good living. But that said, there are writers who are as good as or better than me in my field who do not. I had some enormous luck about a decade ago when ABC in the States, the television network, made an adaptation of my novel, Flash Forward. I was one of the script writers for that show. But you know what Hollywood does? They bring a wheelbarrow full of money to your front door, dump it, and then they go away. I've had some lucky breaks. I've been very fortunate in that sense. And I tried something. I have to say, I did take a gutsy move, because you mentioned that most of my books are set in Canada, many of them in Toronto. And I was flat out told that would be career suicide when I started as a science fiction writer. Every Canadian I met, writer or reader, said, don't do that, don't do that. And I said, but I read Robert Parker. He writes mystery novels set in Boston. That's where he lives. Nobody ever tells him not to do it. Why can't I write science fiction set in Toronto or even Mississauga? They said, no. No one will ever read that. Well, I won an award a few years ago for being the most popular foreign science fiction writer in China. I've won the top science fiction awards three times in Spain, three times in Japan, and in France. My books are in 20-odd languages all over the world. So I took a gamble that Canada was interesting to everybody on the planet, except Canadians, and it paid off nicely for me.
Yeah, it sure did. I mean, it's amazing still to me to pick up a novel. The first of your novels that I discovered was Calculating God, and it's set in Toronto, and it's had a profound effect on me, the novel. Which leads me to my next question, is that religion plays a recurring theme in a lot of your work, including the sort of that interface between religion and science. Are you a particularly religious man? Why is that such a recurring thing?
In fact, I'm an atheist. But 6 years ago this weekend, the University of Winnipeg gave me an honorary doctorate that was jointly sponsored by the Dean of Science and the Emeritus Dean of Theology because of the thoughtful treatment of the science versus religion dialogue in my novels. And that came about because my first job after Ryerson, I was hired by a little group of just four people who were trying to launch what eventually became Vision TV, the multi-faith basic cable channel that Moses Neimer eventually bought, but exists still on basic cable here in Toronto and across Canada. And they were, you know, they wanted this multi-faith, the first one in the world that would have broadcasting from all manners of Christians, all different flavors of Judaism and Islam and Sikhism and Hinduism and Baha'i and everything. And I went in, I didn't ask, and I didn't say I'm an atheist at the interview. But I was an arrogant young atheist. And I thought all these guys were benighted fools. And the head of our little project was the Honorable and the Reverend, he had both titles, David MacDonald, who had been Federal Minister of Communication and Secretary of State in Joe Clark's government. And what I found was all of these believers, men and women of various faiths, weren't the benighted fools that I'd run into in the past, but were very well-read, very bright, very sophisticated thinkers who happened to have a different worldview than I did. And I got fascinated by how, and not a stupid person can believe in spirits in the sky, but how a bright person can. And that has informed an awful lot of my work. But it takes a death. Most of my friends are married. Their first marriage is over. The second one, they don't make a big deal out of, so you don't have to go to churches anymore for weddings. But it takes the death to get me into a place of worship. I was just in a, sadly, in a synagogue. One of my science fiction colleagues, Andrew Weiner, passed away a couple of months ago. But that was the last time I was in a place of worship.
I'm talking with Robert J. Sawyer, a science fiction writer extraordinaire. Lives here in the GTA in Mississauga about his new book, The Oppenheimer Alternative, and himself. Robert, can you stick around for one more segment? I'd love to pick your brain on what is happening in the world today around us and where that might lead. That's next on News Talk 1010. Hey, welcome back. This is Mark Tui. You're listening to News Talk 1010. Thanks for doing so. And for those of you curious about how my social bubble is filling up, if I go through the text board here, I'm getting, so far, I think two people have applied. One of them on the phone, one of them on the text board, possibly the same person. I don't know. So that's going well, I would say, despite being bubble-shamed by Michael Catherwood. My guest this hour is Robert J. Sawyer. He is a science fiction writer, one of the most critically successful and, by the sounds of it, commercially successful around the world. He lives and writes right here in Canada, works, a lot of his stories are set here. We've been talking about his new book, The Oppenheimer Alternative, which is fantastic. I just finished it earlier this week. Great melding of history around the Manhattan Project and Robert Oppenheimer and the challenges of the centuries and sort of a fictional take on what could have happened after that that will get you turning the pages as fast as you can. Highly recommended. Robert, I wanted to turn your attention and pick your brain a little bit about some of the stuff that's going on around us right now. Because not only do you write science fiction, but you also talk with corporations and clients about sort of you're a futurist and sort of what might this mean in the future. And, you know, I've been thinking a lot about this pandemic and the changes to our sort of normal behaviors. One of them is a lot of people, myself even occasionally now, wearing masks. Depending on your job, you might have to wear one all the time. But as we come out of the lockdown and go back into society, more and more masks are becoming essential. How does culture change? How do our lives change if a mask becomes a permanent or a semi-permanent fixture? I mean, do we communicate differently? Does it change how we flirt with people? Are we going to get less sick in the future? What's the impact of this, do you think?
I think it's a huge impact, Mark. The single most appealing thing you can do in terms of body language is smile at somebody. And we're erasing that from the intercourse in its broadest sense of human affairs. We're making it where you look at somebody and you don't know if they're smiling, you don't know if they're frowning, you don't know if they're neutral. And that's an enormous change in how we interact. I love smiling at people, and I like to get a smile back. Everybody likes to smile at a baby and see the baby smile back at them. But you, even when you pass somebody on the street, you know, it's nice if you get a smile, right? So that's a huge thing. The mask, there's no question about it, is depersonalizing. And it's so ironic where we're having all of these quite rightly being having them, protests, about the depersonalization of very, very large segments of our population, and celebrating this month Pride, which is the final recognition of personalization, that we accept people of LGBTQ backgrounds as equal and normal and as, you know, perfectly fine. But in the same time that we're doing that, arguing for everybody to be a person, we're taking away part of our closest humanity, which is our face, and it's going to have a really big psychological impact.
Well, I wonder if it's going to change the way we communicate, because, you know, you talk to actors who play roles in science fiction films where they're wearing heavy makeup or masks or costumes, and they have to overact and compensate for that in order to express the emotions and the intent and the nonverbal side of characters. When you take away, you know, 80% of a person's face, you know, are we going to become all Italian gesticulators or huge eyebrow movements, I wonder.
You know, you're exactly right. As you well know, Star Trek Discovery is filmed here in Toronto, over in the studio district. And I got to go, you know, science fiction writer, I got invited to visit the sets, and I was talking with Doug Jones, who plays Captain Saru, an alien, in his full latex appliances. But when he's not acting, he just chats with you, when, you know, he doesn't do the shtick. And you can see the difference, right? It takes an enormous physical effort to emote. And we have, it's funny because we over-emote in email now, right? If you don't end a sentence with an exclamation mark, it means you're mad. If you don't put a smiley in, people will take it the wrong way, right? We have gone so far bending over backwards in textual communication to make sure, hey, I'm just kidding, I'm cool, everything is wonderful, and we adjectivize everything. Wonderful, fabulous, I would love to do your show this weekend, Mark, instead of, great, we're set for 3:00 on Sunday, which is what we would say on the phone, right? So we're going to have that same thing. You hit exactly on it. We're going to overcompensate to the point where everything is almost walking on eggshells. That guy didn't do the eyebrow dance, and he didn't do the great theatrical wave with his hand when he saw me. So how come he's mad at me? What did I do wrong? What's wrong with him? It's going to change us.
Should I take my money out of stocks in makeup companies and cosmetic firms and put it into hairstyle businesses? Is that going to be the way that you dress up, if you're a woman or somebody uses makeup to go out?
Well, sell lipstick. Right. But eyeshadow, right? Anything that makes your eyes more expressive. The whole point of eyeshadow, I'm no expert, is that it makes your eyes pop on your face, right? Eyeshadow, false eyelashes, anything that's designed to make the eyes even more prominent in the face. That will be a growth area. Anything that makes the mouth look good, including, for that matter, orthodonture. And braces, you know, and Invisalign and all that kind of stuff. I'm not sure I would be opening an orthodonture practice or putting my money in Invisalign stock right now.
Robert J. Sawyer, such a pleasure to have you on the program. We've got to have you back again.
My pleasure, Mark. Anytime. Take care, my friend.
Take care. Robert Sawyer is a science fiction writer, one of the greats, and he's a Canadian boy right here in the GTA, lives in Mississauga, writes from Mississauga. Many of his novels, which are fantastic, are set right here in Canada. His new book, The Oppenheimer Effect, is great. If you're a lover of history, not so big on science fiction, you think, you will love this book. If you enjoy science fiction or speculative fiction, you will love this book. It merges both in a way that you can't easily tell which is which, history or fiction. Highly recommend it. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll have traffic and the week in review.
This News Talk 1010 podcast was brought to you by PocketEmploymentLawyer.ca. Wrongfully dismissed? Changes made to your job? Lowballed on severance? Find out if you have a case before you call a lawyer. Go to PocketEmploymentLawyer.ca.